if someone is assaulted or experiences trauma, there's science and scientific proof. It's biology. The people change. The brain changes. And literally, what it does is it takes the trauma and it puts it in a box and it files it away and shuts it so that we can survive the pain. And it also does a lot of other things. It can cause body pain. It can cause, you know, baseline elevations in anxiety. It can cause complete avoidance of wanting to even remember or think about what happened to you.
Welcome back to Naptime Nancy Podcast. This is part two of my sexual assault story and the physical and mental toll that the PTSD from my rape has affected my life. So, if you haven't listened to part one yet, I recommend starting there. The clip that you just heard was from a 2018 Lady Gaga interview on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. If you need inspiration as a survivor on how to help yourself heal, Lady Gaga has so many public speaking video clips on YouTube alone about her own experience with sexual assault and PTSD. She also wrote the powerful song Till It Happens to You for the 2015 documentary The Hunting Ground about the college sexual assault crisis that many women, men, trans, and gender fluid people face each year on college campuses. Grab the tissues, though, if you watch the music video, because it is powerful. Okay, back to my story. I'm just getting to the buildup of me finally telling my parents about my own sexual assault. There was this tension between my parents and I from them not knowing about my sexual assault, particularly between my dad and I. That had increased quite a bit when the whole Golden State Killer DNA test thing came around after my mom's stepdad was turned in 2016. My dad has always been there for my mom, pretty much ever since she first ran away from home at age 16, give or take a month or two. My dad had endured my mom's night terrors from her complex PTSD brought on by her stepfather's abuse. My dad has been my mom's saving grace for over 40 years. My dad wanted to shield my mom from all the stress of the Golden State Killer case. The anticipation of her stepfather's DNA results was making her increasingly distraught. Meanwhile, I wanted my mom's son-of-a-bitch stepdad to be the Golden State Killer, as crazy as that sounds, so that asshole would finally be behind bars. I was mad. I didn't want to forgive and forget my mom's stepdad and what he did to my mom and my family. I wanted this for my mom so bad. Her stepdad's clearance felt like failure. Learning about the GSK's rapes in the 1970s under the nickname East Area Rapist made me even more pissed, because I became increasingly more aware of the fact that sex crime laws barely changed. And that's being generous. If you don't believe me that things haven't changed, I highly recommend listening to the podcast The Man in the Window. Host Paige St. John does an excellent job giving the Golden State Killer survivors voices in that podcast. In December of 2016, we received the news that my mom's stepdad's DNA was not a match to the Golden State Killer. I was already beating myself up over putting my mom and my family through all of this torment by initially encouraging my mom to come forward and turn her stepfather's name in. But I'm sure my dad was less than thrilled with me as well for putting our family through this horrific journey. My dad got why I encouraged my mom to come forward, of course, but my mom felt less safe than ever. On April 25th, 2018, the world finally saw the Golden State Killer suspect. Joseph James DeAngelo Jr. was a DNA match to the killer who had terrorized California for decades. The killer was not only unmasked, but in custody. It still seems so surreal. The rape attacks that the Golden State Killer committed, though, early on, would never see charges brought against DeAngelo due to statute of limitations. He's still behind bars, though, so there is that. This realization stirred up my emotions and anguish toward my own sexual assault statute of limitations expiring. So I decided to Google my rapist. At the very least, I'm grateful to have my rapist's name. I had hoped that I would see that he was behind bars for some other crime. Instead, I saw that he now works for a sheriff's department in Oregon. I felt sick. I felt responsible for him having a badge. And it turns out that he'd actually threatened someone during a road rage incident while off duty within recent years. I don't say allegedly here because the victim of this road rage incident actually has it recorded from a dash cam. It happened. And my rapist got away with it scot-free. So what else had he done? Who else had he threatened? This news really hit me hard. It scared the shit out of me, to be quite honest. I kept flashing back to the memories of my own sexual assault. What if I had tried to fight back the night he crawled on top of my passed out body? What would have happened? Could I have prevented him from being able to go into law enforcement if I'd spoken up? Has he hurt others? My guilt and anxiety were peak upon this discovery. I immediately thought of the fact that the Golden State Killer wound up being a cop, using his power over citizens to prey on them while he was on the clock. Protect and serve. Right. If my rapist was threatening people off the clock, could he be trusted on the clock? It wasn't until just about 2 months ago that I forced myself to watch Netflix's Unbelievable that my own story began to change for the better. If you haven't seen the series, brace yourself, especially if you're a fellow survivor. The first couple episodes are so hard to get through. I had to take breaks and come back to it, but the show was so worth watching in the end. Marie Adler is the fictional name of one of the survivors in the show Unbelievable, who wound up recanting her story of her terrifying sexual assault after law enforcement badgered her until she couldn't take it anymore, and she said she made the whole thing up. Marie was a childhood sex abuse survivor and a rape survivor, so she understandably shut down when detectives told her that her story wasn't consistent. Complex PTSD can cause survivors to block out details of their horrific experiences to protect them. PTSD can also often mimic ADHD symptoms, so your memory gets even worse when you're recalling trauma under intense scrutiny. Understandably, her story lacked detail, but retelling her trauma over and over again was so traumatic in itself that Marie just wanted to shut down and not have to deal with it anymore. Marie claimed to have made her rape attack up in hopes of putting it behind her. The Washington state jurisdiction that she initially tried to confide in wound up charging her with false reporting. She was shamed by the public and those who knew her, ridiculed, and suicidal. If you don't want spoilers for the show, skip ahead a minute or so, guys, because the inspiration for telling my parents about my sexual assault is because of the outcome and all of the survivors and heroes of the show Unbelievable. Seeing Marie recant her story, watching her be belittled and accused by detectives who are supposed to serve and protect, made me bawl my eyes out, because I pictured a survivor coming into the sheriff's department where my rapist works, telling the story of their own attack. Was my rapist out there belittling survivors into silence? The idea of him having a say over the fate of these poor survivors and protecting perverted assholes like himself enraged me. Those thoughts brought on panic attacks, but I continued watching the show. I needed to see what happened to these women. I needed to see what became of this rapist. It wasn't until two detectives from Colorado, dubbed Karen Duvall and Grace Rasmussen in the show, fought to take down a serial rapist whose fictional name was Christopher McCarthy in 2011. The real detectives' names are Stacey Galbraith and Edna Hendershot, and their heroes that deserve their real names praised by survivors everywhere. They took down the real serial rapist, Mark O'Leary. One thing that unexpectedly triggered my PTSD when watching Unbelievable was that Mark O'Leary looks so much like my own rapist. Obviously different guy, but the same big, ugly, roided out beast baby stature. Serial rapist Mark O'Leary was dumb enough to keep documented proof of each of his victims encrypted on his computer of the women he assaulted in Washington and Colorado between 2008 to 2011. Among those photos was belittled, unbelieved, 2008 Washington survivor Marie Adler. Marie, whose real name is Caitlin, wound up being able to change the laws about how law enforcement is to conduct interviews with rape survivors. She, too, is one of my heroes. It is because of Marie Adler, aka Caitlin, that this next generation of survivors stand a fighting chance to seek justice against their attackers. The story behind Caitlin not being believed and her fellow survivors of O'Leary's attacks initially won a Pulitzer Prize in 2015 for a writing piece titled An Unbelievable Story of Rape, written by T. Christian Miller, ProPublica, and Ken Armstrong, The Marshall Project. I'm forever grateful to all law enforcement who took down serial rapist Mark O'Leary. I'm grateful to the survivors of his attacks and to the writers who helped shed light on this incredibly important story. It honestly changed my life. Thank you. Interesting side note about this case. It hit me after watching Unbelievable that this real-life story of rapist Mark O'Leary affected the outcome of one of the persons surrounding the disappearance of missing Air Force veteran Nonnie Ann Dotson. I covered Nonnie's disappearance in episode 4, and the sentence given to the rapist from that case in 2015 was undoubtedly influenced by Mark O'Leary's trial in the same county when he pled guilty in 2011. In fact, the rapist connected to Nonnie Dotson's case had to have been influenced by Mark O'Leary's attacks himself, given that the attack I refer to in episode 4 was nearly a copycat of Mark O'Leary's modus operandi. I'm trying not to give away the rapist's name in Nonnie Dotson's case in this episode, but only because it's a huge shock and I want people to listen to the episode and help spread the word about Nonnie's disappearance to help bring her home at long last. Both of these rapists, though, received more than a life sentence thanks to Jefferson County. I'd never once even fathomed that this scenario of victims recanting their assaults to law enforcement even happened to survivors before watching Unbelievable. Mostly because I imagine the thought of not being believed when my assault first happened to me and being publicly accused of lying, seeing my rapist get all of the support while I was gaslighted, sounded like an absolute nightmare. Thankfully, I could give a shit if anyone else believes me now. I just wish that I'd had the courage to speak up during the small window of opportunity when I was legally allowed to get justice for my own rape. It makes me wonder how many other survivors have changed their tune and claim that they made up their story and it'd be done with talking about it and done with the whole thing. I was so distraught yet inspired by Unbelievable. I'd been going back to therapy and talking about my sexual assault in the months prior to watching the show. When I originally called seeking a therapist, the receptionist told me that only a male therapist was available. I was leery, as I feared male therapists might not empathize in the way that I felt a female therapist would. But I knew I needed help with all the anxiety that I'd been dealing with. Some of that anxiety stemmed from my family suffering the loss of my aunt in late 2017, who was the youngest of my mom's siblings. She died at just 50 years old. Her trauma 100% played a part in her death. Would I too follow in these footsteps if I didn't get help? I struggled with the anger I had over my mom and her sibling stepfather living out his days as a free man. I still struggle with it. I was angry over his freedom, and I also hadn't dealt with the guilt and outrage I felt over now knowing my own rapist became a cop. I went into therapy incredibly apprehensive. What is a male therapist going to offer me when I had trust issues with males? Well, it turns out, everything. Hearing that I did not deserve what happened to me in college and that it wasn't my fault coming from a male therapist meant so much to me. He has given me perspective that I've never been given before and has taught me a lot about the aftermath of PTSD. And yet, with all the breakthroughs my therapist and I had had, I still never planned on telling my parents about my sexual assault. I was too afraid to hurt them. We actually came up with a plan for me to write my parents each letters, unloading everything about my trauma and how I never wanted to hurt them. I'd written both letters to my parents by the time I watched Unbelievable. There was just something about that powerful story that made me feel like my story was going to come pouring out of my mouth if I wasn't careful around my parents. I wanted to tell them so badly. I just couldn't fathom hurting them like that. It wasn't until my husband and I took the kids to the beach for a weekend, a little over a month or two ago. On the way home, we stopped at a drugstore, and as I was walking through the aisles, I heard the same songs I'd heard playing on my rapist stereo the morning after my attack. Sometimes I can handle those songs if I'm in the right mood, and sometimes I can't. I began to have an anxiety attack and had to take some laps around the store and calm my breathing before I could force a smile and before I could muster up a forced smile and small talk with the cashier. I was just sick of living like this. These anxiety flare-ups from my trauma were never going to get easier if I didn't do something. I thought about my own kids keeping their sexual assault from my husband and I. And that's when I started to entertain the idea of telling my parents what happened. I would never want my kids to live with the anguish over trying to protect my feelings. And I started to realize that, of course, my parents wouldn't want that for me either. I began having anxiety attacks on the way into work because I felt so misunderstood and I wanted to tell so badly, but I wanted to find the right time. I was pretty distraught. Started impulse buying things again and binge eating in an attempt to comfort myself. I've nearly maxed out my credit card. Only this last week did I finally tell my husband about it and the shame and guilt I felt over thinking material items would make me feel better emotionally. I was binge eating up a storm. Binge eating had caused me to gain nearly 100 pounds since my freshman year in college after I was assaulted. All of this is mortifying to admit, but it's going to feel triumphant to overcome. My mom was diagnosed anorexic and bulimic from her trauma, and I promised my mom at a young age that I would never become anorexic or bulimic, so I did the opposite. For those who don't understand eating disorders stemming from trauma, it's about having control over your own body. As with any vice, many survivors battle their eating disorders for a lifetime. I was on the fast track to becoming pre-diabetic, considered obese, and didn't want to go out hardly at all. I live in the area that I grew up in, so seeing people from high school is always bittersweet because I'm constantly trying to talk myself out of thinking that they're only focusing on how much weight I've gained since high school. My anxiety was causing me to feel on edge and really bitchy. I was taking my angst out on those I love, burying my face into my phone and avoiding my surroundings more so than ever, missing out on memories, shutting down socially and avoiding most people who tried to contact me. I still struggle with that. Having ADHD and PTSD is a pain in the ass. Your brain is just constantly fried. It's incredibly hard to stay in chronological order when writing my scripts, for example, if you hadn't noticed. Adderall helps, sure, but only when you get actual sleep. So most days I just coasted, survived, focused on keeping my kids fed and healthy, and not much else. Housework was impossible. And those who spoke up about housework, my weight, whatever they felt I could be doing better at, made me feel anxious and like a failure, and those vices became worse in result. And that goes for judgment upon any vice, I suppose. It's been very eye-opening. I've learned that you have to be ready to change for yourself rather than sitting around and waiting for the motivation to catch up to you eventually. Life will pass you by, and hopefully it won't be too late to make those changes. So one day, I was alone with my dad in the office of our little family business. My dad loves to talk politics. He especially loves to talk to me about politics because he loves to debate, not fight, mind you. And we occasionally tend to have differing opinions when it comes to politics. As we began talking, I brought up those who have spoken out against Judge Kavanaugh. And I just started passionately talking about how I bawled watching Dr. Christine Blasey Ford stand before the entire world and tell her story. How terrifying that must have been for her to do. But she did it anyway, knowing that she would receive death threats, knowing that the world would put her under a microscope and trash her. And I told my dad that the moment I saw Dr. Ford's face, the moment I looked into her terrified, courageous eyes on that television screen, that I believe I saw the truth. Because survivors recognize survivors. And then, the story of my own attack just began pouring out of me. My dad was in shock. The phones began to ring as I finished telling my dad what had happened 16 years ago, and that this man was now in law enforcement. I'll never forget what my dad did next. He picked up the phone lines and he put them on hold. He walked over to me. He wrapped his arms around me in the best dad bear hug and said with tears in his eyes, "I am so sorry that happened to you. I had no idea. I'm so sorry. That was not your fault. I wish I would have known. I wish I could have done something. Please know you can always come to Mom and I for anything." After work, I headed to my parents' home where I told my mom. We all cried some more, and I answered any other questions they could think of at the time. My dad brought up an interesting point. He said that my experience reminded him of the part in the movie Animal House when the actor sees a girl passed out drunk at a party. Suddenly, a devil appears on the guy's shoulder and tells him to go for the opportunity, and an angel on the other shoulder tells him not to. The guy doesn't wind up going through with raping the girl in the movie, but my dad said that part reminded him of just how often that behavior is normalized within our society. My parents expressed to me that everything finally made sense, that they had been so bewildered, hurt, and confused over my actions since I began college. They'd had no idea that I was holding all of this in. I felt a change in our relationship for the better right then and there. After watching my aunt die so young in result of her PTSD, I made a promise to myself that I needed to take care of my health for my family's sake, and that in order to make changes to my physical health actually last, I first needed to address my mental health and begin getting treatment for my PTSD. I wound up being mad at myself for waiting and hesitating to tell my parents for so long. My whole face was swollen from crying for hours upon hours. My eyes were so puffy, and my face had broken out into hives from the stress. I had a splitting headache, and I was drained mentally and physically, just exhausted for days after that. I laid down in my bed the night that I told my parents, and I turned my cell phone camera front-facing to examine myself. I surprised myself by taking a selfie. Then I studied my photo. I looked at myself, all swollen and blotchy, and I no longer saw the unattractiveness of the photo. I saw this strong, badass bitch. I said aloud to the photo, "I love you. You are beautiful. You are strong. You have a good heart. You are a survivor." I felt stronger, but I was surprised at how I realized that I expected all of my vices to instantly disappear after finally opening up, which in part is my ADHD expecting instant results and then, of course, growing frustrated. But trauma does not work like that. Vices don't work like that. It's a tedious yet worthwhile process. My tears wound up lasting for about a week after telling my parents. I just could not stop crying. My binge eating did not get any better either. If anything, it got worse for a bit, and I could not figure out why. I was so frustrated. And then a friend of mine, who happens to be a trauma psychologist, reminded me that I just barely unloaded 16 years worth of pent-up trauma. My body was just still trying to catch up and needs its own time to decompress and heal. It finally occurred to me that, as with any vice, you have to not only want to make lifestyle changes to kick your habits, you have to be mentally prepared to do so as well. You can spend all the time and money on any diet in the world, or detox, go cold turkey from drugs, alcohol, whatever. But until you've faced your trauma head on and can begin healing mentally, you will constantly be falling on and off the wagon. We trauma survivors simply cannot give up our vices without beginning the healing process. And sadly, there is absolutely nothing that anyone can say or do to encourage us to make those changes for our health. It has to be our decision. But I've finally started the process. I'm in therapy specifically for my eating disorder. I listen to podcasts about PTSD and binge eating. I've begun exercising again, and I've started the book The Body Keeps the Score by Dr. Wessel van der Kolk. An incredible book, by the way. I recommend it for both survivors and those who are kind enough to seek understanding and empathy for survivors of any sort of trauma. I know now that my recovery will not happen overnight, but I'm making these changes because I want to be here for my kids. And I want their memories of me and their childhood to be mostly good memories. All of us happy. I want them to have the kind of childhood that I did, where we went on adventures around Mount Hood, hiking, camping, boating, biking, exploring, doing the kinds of activities that require some physical conditioning. I want to help my kids have healthy relationships with food and know how to properly take care of their mental health and manage their stress when needed. Someday, I will share with my kids what happened to me, because I want them to know how amazing and supportive their grandparents are in supporting me, and the toll that it took on me mentally and physically, keeping that big of a secret for 16 years, in hopes that they don't worry about their own trauma hurting me or their father. I can honestly say that I feel stronger than I ever have after having finally told my parents. And I still feel terrible for having to tell them that someone hurt their baby. But telling them has been one of the best decisions that I've ever made for my own health. I have the support from the people that I love and care about the most. It doesn't matter now if anyone else in the world winds up believing me at this point, because everyone that I care about has my back, believes me. That's a powerful feeling, and I feel incredibly fortunate to have that as a survivor. Not every survivor gets to feel this strength, so I don't take it for granted. I finally feel hopeful for my future and for my family, and that makes me so excited. My goal in sharing my long-winded story with all of you is not to toot my own horn or turn myself into some martyr. My goal is to simply support and encourage other survivors to get the help that they need to cope with their PTSD. Because there are so many survivors out there who don't realize that they can't just sweep their own trauma under the rug. That pain will catch up to you. It will take shape mentally, physically, or likely both. Don't let that pain catch up to you. Don't let your trauma get the better of you. Don't let whomever hurt you win. They don't get to win. You are too important. I do want to emphasize, though, that even though my rapist is in law enforcement, that I know not all law enforcement are bad people. I still very much respect most of those in law enforcement. I just wanted to make sure that that was known. If sharing my story helps one survivor, or even the parents of one survivor, recognize that their own child, however old, may have had similar experiences and are suffering from PTSD, then I will be thrilled. It was worth it to share my story regardless, and I know now that I'm capable of thriving. Here are some resources for those interested in seeking help for their own PTSD. The National Sexual Assault Hotline is 1-800-656-4673. They also have an online chat feature on their website at hotline.rann.org. That's R, A as in Apple, I, N as in Nancy, N as in Nancy.org. This resource is for both sexual assault survivors and parents of sexual assault survivors. If you're a military veteran who's been sexually assaulted within or out of the military, and or would like to seek help regarding your PTSD but don't feel comfortable speaking up to the VA about it, I highly recommend the non-government affiliated program Vets for Warriors. They have both male and female staff members available to assist you in your recovery. Their phone number is 1-855-838-8255, or visit their website and email or live chat with someone who can help at vetsforwarriors.com. That four in the middle of vetsforwarriors.com is just the single digit four. The National Domestic Abuse Hotline is 1-800-799-7233 at thehotline.org. The National Suicide Hotline is 1-800-273-8255, or visit their website at suicidepreventionlifeline.org. YouTube has some excellent resources regarding eating disorders from trauma, and even hypnotherapy for a variety of different vices, including binge eating. Intro music to this episode is Backdoor Brawl by Mark Wallach. Rights to the song purchased on premiumbeats.com. Media sources include the September 23rd, 2019 Vulture.com article, The True Stories Behind Unbelievable by Lisa Liebman, The Late Show with Stephen Colbert's YouTube channel, the book Case Files of the Golden State Killer by Kat Winters and Keith Quomos. Thank you again so much for taking the time to listen to my story. It means the world. Next episode, we dive back into more true crime during nap time.